Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. All this week, the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures, The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, by Wade Davis. The CBC Massey Lectures began in 1961, and over the years, these broadcasts have become a place where the best minds of our time discuss the issues that face us, both as Canadians and as citizens of the world. The three partners in this great enterprise are CBC Radio, Massey College in the University of Toronto, and House of Anansi Press, publisher of the book of the lectures. In earlier years, the Masseys were recorded in a radio studio, but 7 years ago, we took the lectures out of the studio and onto the road, so the lectures you're hearing this week were all recorded in front of a live audience, this year in Yellowknife, Vancouver, Halifax, Montreal, and Toronto. The 2009 CBC Massey lecturer is anthropologist, filmmaker, and writer Wade Davis, whose curiosity and researches have ranged from zombies in Haiti to sacred plants in South America. Among many books, he's the author of The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was made into a movie, and One River, nominated for the Governor General's Award. The myriad of cultures of the world are not failed attempts at modernity, let alone failed attempts to be us, says Wade Davis. They are unique expressions of the human imagination and heart, unique answers to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? From the Northern Arts and Cultural Center in Yellowknife, here's Wade Davis with Season of the Brown Hyena, the first of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
You know, one of the intense pleasures of travel is the opportunity to live amongst those who have not forgotten the old ways, who still feel their past in the wind, touch it in stones polished by rain, taste it in the bitter leaves of plants. And just to know that in the Amazon, jaguar shamans still journey beyond the Milky Way, or that in the high Arctic, the myths of the Inuit elders still resonate with meaning, or that in the Himalaya, the Buddhists still pursue the breath of the Dharma, is to remember the central revelation of anthropology, and that is the idea that the world into which you were born does not exist in some absolute sense, but is just one model of reality, the consequence of one particular adaptive and intellectual choices that your lineage made, however successfully, many generations ago. But whether we travel with a nomadic Penan in the rainforests of Borneo, a voodoo acolyte in Haiti, a curandero in the Andes of South America, or a yak herder on the slopes of Shomalungma, all of these peoples teach us that there are other options, other possibilities, other ways of thinking and orienting yourself in social and spiritual space, other ways of interacting with the earth itself. And this is an idea that, if you think about it, can only fill you with hope. Now, together, the myriad of cultures of the world make up a intellectual and a spiritual web of life that envelops the planet and is every bit as important to the well-being of the planet as is a biological web of life that you know as a biosphere. And you could think of this social web of life as being an ethnosphere. And you could define the ethnosphere perhaps most appropriately as a sum total of all thoughts and intuitions, myths and beliefs, ideas and inspirations brought into being by the human consciousness since the dawn of our existence. The ethnosphere is humanity's greatest legacy. It is the product of our dreams, the embodiment of our hopes, and the symbol of all that we've created as a wildly imaginative and creative species. And just as the biosphere, the biological matrix of life, is being severely eroded by the destruction of habitat and the resultant loss of plant and animal life, so too is the ethnosphere, only at a far greater rate. No biologist, for example, would suggest that 50% of all species are moribund or on the brink of extinction, because it simply is not true. And yet this, the most apocalyptic scenario, in the realm of biological diversity scarcely approaches what we know to be the most optimistic scenario in the realm of cultural diversity. And the great indicator, of course, the canary in the coal mine, if you will, is language loss. A language, of course, is not merely a set of grammatical rules or a vocabulary. A language is a flash of the human spirit. It's a vehicle through which the soul of each particular culture comes into the material world. Every language is an old-growth forest of the mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of social and spiritual possibilities. And of the 7,000 languages spoken today, fully half are not being taught to children. Effectively, unless something changes, they will disappear within our lifetimes. Half the languages of the world are teetering on the brink of extinction. Just think about it. What could be more lonely than to be enveloped in silence, to be the last of your people to speak your native tongue, to have no way to pass on the wisdom of your ancestors or to anticipate the promise of your descendants? Yet this tragic plight is indeed the fate of someone somewhere on earth roughly every 2 weeks, because on average, every fortnight, an elder passes away and carries with him or her into the grave the last syllables of an ancient tongue. And what this really means is that within a generation or two, we will be witnessing the loss of fully half of humanity's social, cultural, and intellectual legacy. This is the hidden backdrop of our age, and it doesn't have to happen. Now, there are those who quite innocently say, well, wait a minute, wouldn't the world be a better place if we all spoke the same language? Wouldn't communication be facilitated? Wouldn't it be easier for us to get along? And my answer to that is always to say, what a wonderful idea. But let's make that universal language Haida. Let's make it Yoruba. Let's make it Inuptituk. Let's make it Lakota. Let's make it San. Let's make it Quechua. And suddenly, native speakers of English in particular get a sense of what it would mean to be unable to speak their mother tongue. Now, there are other people who say, wait a minute, haven't languages, come and gone throughout history? Well, of course they have. Babylonian is no longer spoken in the streets of Baghdad or Latin in the hills of Italy. But again, the biological analogy is useful. Extinction in nature is a natural phenomenon. But in general, speciation, the evolution of new forms of life, has outpaced species loss over the last 600 million years, making the world an ever more diverse place. By the same token, when the sounds of Latin faded from Rome, they found new expression in the Romance languages. But today, just as plants and animals are disappearing in what biologists recognize as an unprecedented wave of extinction, so too languages are dying at such a rate that they leave in their wake no descendants. Over 600 of the languages of the world today have fewer than 100 speakers. Some 3,500 are kept alive by a fifth of 1% of the global population. By contrast, the 10 most prevalent languages are thriving. They are the mother tongues of half of humanity. Fully 80% of the world's population communicates in one of just 83 languages. But what of the poetry, songs, and knowledge encoded in the other voices? Those cultures that are the guardians and custodians of 98.8% of the world's linguistic diversity. Is the wisdom of an elder any less important simply because he or she communicates to an audience of one? Is the value of a people a simple correlate of their numbers? To the contrary, every culture is by definition a vital branch of our family tree, a repository of knowledge and experience, and if given the opportunity, a source of inspiration and promise for the future. When you lose a language, MIT linguist Ken Hale remarked not long before he passed away, you lose a culture, intellectual wealth, a work of art. It's like dropping a bomb on the Louvre. But what exactly is at stake, and what, if anything, should be done about it? A number of books over recent years have paid homage to the global sweep of technology and modernity, you know, suggesting that the world is flat, that one does not have to emigrate to innovate, that we are fusing into a single reality dominated by a specific model of economics, that the future is to be found everywhere and all at once. When I read these books, I can only think that I must have been traveling in very different circles from these writers. The world that I've been fortunate to know, as I hope these lecturers will demonstrate, is most assuredly not flat. It is full of peaks and valleys, curious anomalies, and divine distractions. History has not stopped, and the processes of cultural change and transformation remain as dynamic today as ever. The world can only appear monochromatic to those who persist in interpreting what they experience through the lens of a single cultural paradigm, their own. For those with the eyes to see and the heart to feel, it remains a rich and complex topography of the spirit. Now, it may seem unusual to begin a celebration of culture and diversity with a nod to genetics, but this is really where the story begins. For nearly 10 years, my friend and colleague at the National Geographic Society, Spencer Wells, has been leading the Genographic Project, an extraordinarily ambitious global effort to track through both space and time the primordial journey of humanity. What he and other population geneticists have discovered is simply one of the great revelations of modern science. We are, as Spencer reminds us, the result of over a billion years of evolutionary transformations. Our DNA, encoded in four simple letters, is a historical document that reaches back to the origin of life. Each one of us is a chapter in the greatest story ever written, a narrative of exploration and discovery remembered not only in myth, but encoded in our blood. Every cell in our bodies is charged by a miracle, a double helix of four molecule types, four simple letters, A, C, G, and T, linked in complex sequences that help orchestrate every pulse of sentient existence. There are 6 billion bits of data wrapped and coiled and spun in the darkness of our beings. If the DNA in any human body, each one of you in this audience, were to be stretched out into a single line, it would reach not just to the moon, but to 3,000 celestial spheres equidistant from the Earth. In life, of course, this chain, this mystic inheritance, is broken and bundled into 46 chromosomes, which pass down through the generations. With each new coupling, each new child, these chromosomes are shuffled and reassembled such that each of us is born as a unique combination of the genetic endowment of our parents. Almost all human DNA, 99.9% of the 3 billion nucleotides, does not vary from person to person. But woven into the remaining 0.1% are revelations, differences in the raw code itself that yield vital clues about human ancestry. Inevitably, during the transcription and replication of genetic information, these billions of bits of data, small glitches occur. Where the letter A ought to be, there appears a G. These are mutations, and they happen all the time. They are not cataclysmic. Rarely would a single mutation make for phenotypic changes. A shift in a single letter of the code does not change the color of the skin, the height of the body, let alone the intelligence and destiny of the person. But this genetic drift does, however, remain indelibly encoded in the genes of that individual's descendants. So these single, limited, inherited mutations become the markers, the seams and spot welds, as my friend Spencer always says, that over the last 20 years have allowed population geneticists to reconstruct the story of human origins and migration with a precision that would have been unimaginable a generation ago. The overwhelming scientific consensus suggests that all of humanity lived in Africa until some 60,000 years ago. Then, perhaps driven by changing climatic and ecological conditions, a small band of men, women, and children, possibly as few as 150 individuals, walked out of the ancient continent and began the colonization of the world. What propelled the multiple ways of the human diaspora can never be fully known, though presumably food and other resource imperatives played a role. And as populations grew beyond the carrying capacity of any particular piece of land, they splintered, and some bands moved on. What the DNA record reveals is that as smaller groups split off, they carried only a subset of the genetic diversity originally present in the African population. Indeed, the science indicates clearly that for all human cultures, wherever they ended up, genetic diversity decreases the further both in time and space that a people are removed from Africa. A first wave followed the shoreline of Asia, traversing the underbelly of Asia to reach Australia as early as 50,000 years before the present. A second migration moved north through the Middle East and then turned east, dividing once again some 40,000 years ago, sending movements south into India, west and south through Southeast Asia to southern China, and north into Central Asia. From there, out of the brooding mountains at the heart of the world's largest continent, two subsequent migrations brought people west to Europe and east to Siberia, which was populated by roughly 20,000 years ago. Finally, some 12,000 years ago, even as a new wave came out of the Middle East into southeastern Europe and people moved north through China, a small band of hunters crossed the land bridge of Beringia and established for the first time a human presence in the Americas. Within 2,000 years, their descendants had reached Tierra del Fuego. From humble origins in Africa, after a journey that lasted 2,500 generations, a hegira 40,000 years in the making, our species had settled the entire habitable world. Now, before going any further, let me step back and explain why I think this genetic research is so important, for this really provides the foundation for all of the themes and issues that will be discussed in these Massey lectures. Nothing that has emerged from science in my lifetime, with the possible exception of the vision of the Earth from space brought home to us by Apollo, has done more to liberate the human spirit from the parochial tyrannies that have haunted us since the birth of memory. As a social anthropologist, a young student at Harvard, I was trained to believe in the primacy of history and culture as the key determinants in human affairs, so it must strike you as unusual that I'm celebrating the revelations of genetics. I was raised, of course, to believe in nurture, if you will, as opposed to nature. Anthropology began as an attempt to decipher the exotic other, with the ideal hope that by embracing the wonder of distinct and novel cultural possibilities, we might enrich our appreciation and understanding of all human nature and thus of our own humanity. Very early on, however, the discipline was hijacked by the ideology of its times. As naturalists throughout the 19th century attempted to classify creation, even as they cope with the revelations of Darwin, anthropologists became servants of the crown, agents dispatched to the far reaches of empire with the task of understanding strange tribal peoples and cultures that they might be properly administered and controlled. Evolutionary theory, distilled from the study of bird beaks, beetles, and barnacles, slipped into social theory in a manner that proved useful to the age. It was, in fact, an anthropologist, Herbert Spencer, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. At a time when the United States was being built upon the labor of African slaves, and the British class system was so stratified that children of the wealthy were on average 6 inches taller than those of the poor, a theory that provided a scientific rationale for differences in race and class was a welcome convenience. Evolution, of course, suggested change through time. And this, together with the Victorian cult of improvement, implied a progression in the affairs of human beings, a ladder of success that rose from the so-called primitive to the civilized, from the tribal village of Africa to London and the splendor of the Strand. The cultures of the world came to be seen as a living museum in which individual societies represented evolutionary moments captured and mired in time, each one a stage in the imagined ascent to civilization. It followed with the certainty of Victorian rectitude that advanced societies had the obligation to assist the backward, to civilize the savage, a moral duty that again played well into the needs of empire. So having established the primacy of race and the inherent superiority of Victorian England, anthropologists were sent out to prove the case. The scientific mismeasure of man began as phrenologists with calipers and rulers detected and recorded minute differences in skull morphology, which were presumed to reflect innate differences in intelligence. Before long, physical anthropologists were measuring and photographing peoples throughout the world, all with the deeply flawed notion that a complete classification of our species could be attained simply by comparing body parts, the shape of hips, the texture of hair, and inevitably, the color of skin. Science is only one way of knowing, and its purpose is not to generate absolute truths, but rather to inspire better and better ways of thinking about phenomena. As recently as 1965, American anthropologist Carlton Coon wrote two books, The Origin of Races and The Living Races of Man, in which he advanced the theory that there were five distinct human subspecies. The political and technological dominance of Europeans, Coon suggested, was a natural consequence of their evolved genetic superiority. He even asserted that racial intermixture can upset the genetic as well as the social equilibrium of a group. Coon at the time was the president of the American Association of Physical Anthropologists, a full professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and curator of ethnology at the university's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. That such statements, convenient as they were during the last years of Jim Crow and segregation, were seriously entertained by the academic community as recently as 1965, should certainly give us pause as we consider the implication of the new research in population genetics. But when the science, in fact, suggests an end to race, when it reveals beyond any reasonable doubt that race is a fiction, it behooves us to listen. We should at least hope that for once the scientists have it right. And they do. They have revealed beyond any doubt that the genetic endowment of humanity is a single continuum. From Ireland to Japan, from the Amazon to Siberia, there are no sharp genetic differences amongst populations. There are only geographical gradients. The most remote society on Earth contains within its people fully 85% of our total genetic diversity. Were the rest of humanity to be swept away by plague or war, the Warani or the Barasana, the Rendili or the Toreg, would have within their blood the genetic endowment of all humanity. Like a sacred repository of spirit and mind, any one of these cultures, any one of the 7,000, could provide the seeds from which humanity, in all of its diversity, could be reborn. What this all means is that biologists and population geneticists have at last proved to be true something that philosophers have always dreamed. We are all literally brothers and sisters. We are all cut from the same genetic cloth. It follows, by definition, that all cultures share essentially the same mental acuity, the same raw genius. And whether this intellectual capacity and potential is exercised in stunning works of technological wizardry and innovation, which has been the great achievement of the West and of industrial Europe, or by contrast, placed into unraveling the complex threads of memory inherent in a myth the great achievement of the Aboriginal people of Australia is simply a matter of choice, orientation, adaptive insights, and cultural priorities. There is no hierarchy of progress in the history of culture, no social Darwinian ladder to success. The Victorian notion of the savage and the civilized, with European industrial society sitting proudly at the apex of a pyramid of advancement that widens at the base to the so-called primitives of the world, has been thoroughly discredited, indeed scientifically ridiculed for the racial and colonial conceit that it was. The brilliance of scientific research and the revelations of modern genetics have affirmed in an astonishing way the essential connectedness of humanity. We share a sacred endowment, a common history written in our bones. It follows, as all these Massey lectures will suggest, that the myriad of cultures of the world are not failed attempts at modernity, let alone failed attempts to be us. They are, by definition, unique expressions of the human imagination and heart, unique answers to a fundamental question: what does it mean to be human and alive? And when asked that question, the cultures of the world respond with 7,000 vital voices, and these collectively comprise our human repertoire for dealing with all of the challenges that will confront us as a species over the next 2,500 generations, even as we continue this never-ending journey.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius Satellite Radio 137 across North America, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. The myriad of cultures in our world make up an intellectual and spiritual web of life that envelops the planet, argues Wade Davis, and is every bit as important as the biological web of life. From the Northern Arts and Cultural Center in Yellowknife, Season of the Browned Hyena, the first of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
But who were these people who walked out of Africa so many thousands of years ago? What were they like? If we can track their subsequent journey through inherited genetic markers, presumably it should be possible to find a people still living in Africa, a people who never left, and whose DNA therefore lacks all evidence of the mutations that occurred among the successive waves that spread our ancestors throughout the world. Such a people have in fact been identified, and they are a culture that has fascinated anthropologists for decades. Living today in the Syrian sands of the Kalahari, 55,000 strong, scattered across some 84,000 square kilometers of Botswana, Namibia, and southern Angola, the San have long been considered the descendants of a people who at one time inhabited the entire subcontinent and much of East Africa. Displaced by successive waves of agriculturalists and pastoral herders, the San survived as bushmen, nomadic hunters and gatherers, men and women whose precise and exacting knowledge allowed their people alone to survive in one of the most forbidding and parsimonious desert landscapes on Earth. Their extraordinary body of adaptive information, their intellectual toolkit, is encoded in the words and sounds of a native tongue that is a linguistic marvel, a language totally unrelated to any other known family of languages on Earth. In everyday English, we use 31 sounds. The language of the San has 141, a cacophony of cadence and clicks that many linguists believe echoes the very birth of language. Indeed, the genetic information suggests that this may indeed be the case. The absence of key markers indicates that the San were the first people in what became the family tree of humanity. If the Irish and the Lakota, the Hawaiian and the Maya are the branches and the limbs, the San are the trunk, and quite possibly the oldest culture in the world. When the rest of us decided to travel, the San elected to stay home. Certainly until the early years of the 20th century, when the impact of alcohol and education and the false and twisted promises of development shattered many of their lives, the San had followed the rhythm of their natural world for perhaps 10,000 years. They had little choice. Their very survival depended on their ability to anticipate every nuance of the seasons, every movement of the animals, the very sounds that plants make as they grow. Water was a constant challenge. In the Kalahari, there is no standing water for 10 months of the year. Water has to be found in the hollows of trees, sucked from beneath the mud with hollow reeds, or cached in ostrich eggs, plugged with grass and marked with the sign of the owner. For most of the year, the only source of water for the San is liquid found in roots or squeezed from the guts of animals. During the dry season, May through the end of December, the San are constantly on the move. Though they primarily think of themselves as hunters, they survive by eating plants, with each adult consuming 5 kilograms of wild melon every day. And when the melons wither, the San must dig. In a desert environment where the body loses 3 liters a day in sweat, it takes more than 20 large tubers of wild melon, each dug from the sand, to keep a person alive. In the worst and most desperate months, the season of the brown hyena, the San scrape hollows in the ground, moisten the earth with urine, and then lie completely still beneath a sprinkling of sand, tormented by flies as they wait out the heat of the day. The sun for the San is not a source of life, but a symbol of death. The time of greatest privation is also the time of promise, for in October begin the little rains, the first teasing raindrops heralding the end of the period of drought. For 3 months from October through December, the land is tormented by the promise of rain, which is never enough. Those fortunate to live around permanent water huddle in small encampments, but the majority forage by dusk and dawn for roots. The heat continues, and dry winds sweep over the brown grasslands, and the spirits of the dead appear as dust devils spinning across a gray and yellow horizon. Finally, in January, arrive the rains, and for 3 months, the people celebrate a season of rebirth and regeneration. In the Kalahari, the possibility of dying of thirst is a constant, even in the season of the rains. The favorite time of year is the month of April, the season of the hunter. Though plants comprise the bulk of the San diet, meat is the most desired food, as it is the hunt that transforms a boy into a man. By April, in most years, the rains have driven away the heat, and the bitter cold of desert winter has yet to set in. There is ripe food in abundance everywhere, beneath the ground, upon the vines, on every limb of every tree and shrub. The antelope, having calved their young, are fat and plentiful. Territory is forgotten as the men range across the desert in small hunting parties, walking as far as 60 kilometers in a day, returning to the fire and the families each night. The men travel light, short bow and quiver of arrows made from root capped in the scrotum of the prey, fire-making sticks, a hollow reed for sucking water, a knife, a short spear, a blob of vegetable gun to make repairs, a sharpened stick for holding meat to the flame. Hunting in teams, the San watch for signs. Nothing escapes their notice. A bend in a blade of grass, the direction of the tug that snapped a twig, the depth, shape, and condition of a track. Everything is written in the sand. From a single animal track, San hunters can discern direction, time, rate of travel. Adultery among the San is a challenge because every human footprint is immediately recognizable in the sand. So armed with this ingenuity and living in direct competition with serious predators such as leopards and lions, the San manage to kill an astonishing array of creatures. Risking their lives, they run upon the heels of elephants, hamstringing the enormous animals with a swift blow of the axe. Hovering near a lion kill, they wait until the animal is satiated and chase the sluggish cats from the carcasses of the dead. Birds are snared on the fly with nets. Antelope are literally run to the ground, often over a period of days. The hunt is the metaphor that brings us into the very heart of San life. A man who does not hunt remains a child. To marry, a man must bring meat to the parents of the bride. A first antelope kill is a high point of youth, a moment recorded for all time in the skin of the hunter by his father, who makes a shallow incision with bone and rubs into the wound a compound of meat and fat, scarring the right side of the body if the kill is a buck, the left if it is a doe. The tattoo marks the boy with the heart of a hunter, a potent source of magic, for the San do not simply kill game. They engage in a dance with the prey, a ritual exchange that ends with the creature literally making of itself an offering, a sacrifice. Every hunt ends in exhaustion, as the antelope realizes that whatever it does, it cannot escape the pursuit of man. It then turns, stops, and the arrow flies. The meat of large prey is shared among all peoples of the encampment, the distribution determined not by the hunter, but by the owner of the arrow. San men are always giving each other gifts of arrow. The arrow, with its tip of bone, its elegant shaft, its perfect blend of poison, represents the highest achievement of San technology. But its power lies not in technology, but in the realm of the social. Each exchange of the arrows establishes bonds of reciprocity that forge the solidarity of San lives. To refuse a gift is an act of hostility. To accept is to acknowledge both the connection and the obligation. The arrow represents much more than a debt that must be honored by trade or reimbursed over time. Rather, it secures a lifelong duty that welds the individual to the greater social sphere, brings the youth into the realm of the hunter, and the hunter into the circle of the hearth and the sacred fire. If the San associate the sun with death, fire symbolizes life, the unity of the people, the survival of the family. Whereas a gift of meat formalizes the betrothal of a woman, divorce is finalized the moment she simply returns to her family's fire. A mother gives birth in the darkness and announces the delivery by moving back into the circle of firelight. When an elder grows too old and weak to continue with the people, he is left behind to die, protected from the hyenas by a circle of thorn scrub and a fire at his feet to light his way into the next world. For the San, there are two great spirits, the great god of the eastern sky and the lesser god of the west, a source of negativity and darkness, the custodian of the dead. To ward off the god of the west, to deflect the arrows of disease and misfortune, the San dance around the fire, casting their beings into trance. The vital force of life that resides in the belly rises up the spine as a vapor, touches the base of the skull, diffuses through the body, and spins the spirit into a higher consciousness. The healing dance ends every day, every morning, with the hunters around the fire, having teased the flames and the gods by placing their own heads into the burning coals. So there you have it. Language, stealth, spirit, adaptive genius. These were the tools that allowed the San to survive the Kalahari. And these two presumably were the attributes of our distant ancestors and the people that carried those gifts out of Africa. But an ethnographic portrait of the San today, or the San as they lived before the ravages of colonialism, still leaves us with fundamental questions about our origins. How can we reach back in time to touch the essence of these early earth wanderers, these ancestral beings who found their way to every habitable place on the planet? What did they know? How did they think? What inspired them beyond the raw challenges of staying alive? At some point, it all began. Well, we know that the hominid lineage dates back in Africa for millions of years. The earliest skeletal remains are those of a three-year-old girl discovered in 2006 in the Afar Desert of Ethiopia. She was named by science Australopithecus afarensis, after the place where she was found and where her bones had rested for 3.3 million years. Our own species, Homo sapiens, did not evolve until a mere 200,000 years ago, and we had direct competitors. The human population, in fact, ebbed and flowed, and at one junction, we were very nearly extinguished, reduced to perhaps 1,000 individuals. But something pulled us back from extinction. For most of our history, we shared the world with another branch of the hominid tree, our remote cousins, the Neanderthals, who were descendants of the same progenitor, Homo erectus. Neanderthals clearly had awareness. They used tools, and there is evidence of deliberate burial as early as 70,000 years ago. But whether it was an increase in the size of the brain, the development of language, or some other evolutionary catalyst, our species possessed competitive advantages that ultimately would launch its destiny in an astonishing manner, an explosion of intellect and spirit that left Neanderthal man gasping for survival. There is one place on Earth where today you can witness this primordial flash of the spirit, and it lies beneath the ground in southwest France and beyond the Pyrenees in Spain. By the time the last vestiges of Neanderthal life slipped away from Europe 27,000 years ago, the stunning Upper Paleolithic cave art created by your direct ancestors was already several thousand years old. Reaching deep into the earth through narrow passages that opened into chambers illuminated by the flicker of tallow lamps, men and women drew with stark realism the animals they revered, singly or in herds, using the contour of the stone to animate forms so dramatically that entire caverns come alive today with creatures long since lost to extinction. The sophistication of the figurative art at Chauvet and Altamira, and at later sites such as Lascaux and Pechmel, is astonishing not only for its transcendent beauty, but also for what it tells us about the fluorescence of human potential once brought into being by culture. The technical skills alone, the exploitation of red ochre and black manganese, iron oxide and charcoal to yield a full palette of colors, the use of scaffolding, the diverse techniques to apply the pigments, are themselves remarkable and suggest a relatively high level of social organization and specialization that is echoed in the genius of the Upper Paleolithic toolkit, the elegant scrapers and blades pounded from flint. The use of negative space and shadow, the sense of composition and perspective, the superimposition of animal forms through time indicates a highly evolved artistic aesthetic, but that itself implies the expression of some even deeper yearning. I recently spent a month in France in the Dordogne with my friend Clayton Eshelman, the poet, who has been studying the cave art for more than 30 years, ever since the fateful morning in the spring of 1974, when he abandoned, as he put it, the world of bird song and blue sky for a realm of constricted darkness that filled his being with mystical enthusiasm. Like so many observers before him, Clayton was dazzled yet perplexed not just by what he saw, but how he felt in the sensory isolation of the caves, his imagination suspended between consciousness and the soul of an all-devouring earth, a living and fathomless reservoir, as he put it, of psychic force. He paid attention not only to what was depicted on the rock, but also to what was missing, the bison and the horse being the most commonly portrayed animals, with carnivores represented the least. The images float in isolation, There are no backgrounds and no ground lines. Depictions of people are few, and there are no displays of fighting, no scenes of hunting, no representations of physical conflict. Northrop Frye struggled himself in vain to assign purpose to these remarkable works of art from the Upper Paleolithic. He felt that the art paid homage to that moment when human beings, through consciousness, separated themselves from the animal realm, emerging as a unique entity that we now know ourselves to be. Viewed in this light, the art may be seen almost as postcards of nostalgia, laments for a lost time when animals and people were one. Proto-shamanism, the great and first human spiritual impulse, really grew as an attempt to reconcile and even reestablish through ritual a separation that was irrevocable. What is perhaps most remarkable is the fact that the fundamental aesthetic of Upper Paleolithic cave art remained essentially unchanged for 20,000 years, five times the chronological distance that separates us today from the construction of the Great Pyramid at Giza. If this art, if these images, were indeed postcards of nostalgia, ours was a very long farewell indeed. And the cave art also marked the beginning of our discontent, the restless quest for meaning and understanding that has propelled the human dream ever since. Our entire existential experience as a species over the last 50,000 years may be distilled into two words, how and why. These are the departure points for all inquiry, the slivers of insight around which all cultures have crystallized. All peoples, if you think about it, face the same adaptive imperatives. We all must give birth, raise, educate, and protect our children, console our elders as they move into their final years. Virtually all cultures on Earth would endorse most tenets of the Ten Commandments, not because the Judaic world was uniquely inspired, but because it articulated the rules that allowed any social species to thrive. Few societies on Earth fail to outlaw murder or thievery. All create traditions that bring consistency to coupling and procreation. Every culture honors its dead, even as it struggles with the meaning of the inexorable separation that death implies. But given these common challenges, the range and diversity of human cultural adaptations is astonishing. Hunting and gathering societies have flourished from the rainforest of Southeast Asia and the Amazon to the dry flat deserts of Australia, from the Kalahari to the remote icy reaches of the high Arctic, from the broad American plains to the pampas of Patagonia. Wayfinders and fishermen have settled virtually every island chain in all of the world's oceans. Complex societies have been built on the bounty of the sea alone, the salmon, ulakan, and herring that brought life to the First Nations of the Pacific Northwest. With the Neolithic Revolution some 10,000 years ago, humans began to domesticate plants and animals. Pastoral nomads settled the marginal reaches of the planet, the sands of the Sahara, the Tibetan Plateau, the windswept expanses of the Asian steppe. Agriculturalists took a handful of wild grasses, wheat, barley, rice, oats, millet, and maize, and from their bounty generated surpluses, food that could be stored, thus allowing for hierarchy, specialization, and sedentary life, all the hallmarks of civilization as traditionally defined. Great cities arose, and in time, kingdoms, empires, and nation states. No series of lectures, of course, can do justice to the full wonder of the human cultural experience. I mean, the very word culture defies precise definition, even as a concept embraces multitudes. A small, isolated society of a few hundred men and women in the mountains of New Guinea has its own culture, but so too do countries such as Ireland and France. Distinct cultures may share similar spiritual beliefs. Indeed, this is the norm in lands that have been inspired by Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism. While language in general tends to delineate unique worldviews, there are many peoples in Alaska, for example, that have lost their ability to speak the native tongues, yet still maintain a vibrant and thriving sense of their own culture. Perhaps the closest we can come to a meaningful definition of culture is the acknowledgement that each is a unique and ever-changing constellation that we recognize through the observation and study of its language, its religion, social and economic organization, decorative arts, stories, myths, ritual practices and beliefs, and a host of other adaptive traits and characteristics. The full measure of a culture embraces both the actions of a people and the quality of their aspirations, the nature of the metaphors that propel their lives. And no description of a people can be complete without reference to the character of their homeland, the ecological and geographical matrix in which they have determined to live out their destiny. Just as landscape defines character, culture springs from a spirit of place. Over the course of these Massey lectures, I really look forward to sharing my excitement of the wonder of these remarkable realities. What ultimately we will discover on this journey will be our mission for the next century. There is a fire burning over the earth, taking with it plants and animals, ancient skills, and visionary wisdom. At risk is a vast archive of knowledge and expertise, a catalog of the imagination, an oral and written language composed of the memories of countless elders and healers, warriors, farmers, fishermen, midwives, poets, and saints. In short, the artistic, intellectual, and spiritual expression of the full complexity and diversity of the human experience. Quelling this flame, this spreading inferno, and rediscovering a new appreciation for the diversity of the human spirit as expressed by culture is among the central challenges of our times. Thank you very much.
From the Northern Arts and Cultural Center in Yellowknife, you've been listening to Season of the Brown Hyena, the first of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures by Wade Davis. The book of the 2009 Massey Lectures is published by House of Anansi Press and is available across Canada. You can purchase The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, either as a book or CD, by going to the IDEAS website, cbc.ca/ideas. Tonight's lecture was recorded in Yellowknife by Peter Skinner with recording engineer Kevin Woldham. The 2009 CBC Massey Lectures were produced for IDEAS by Philip Coulter. The CBC Massey Lectures are co-sponsored by CBC Radio, the House of Anansi Press, and Massey College in the University of Toronto. The executive producer of IDEAS is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.